Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service, bringing you extraordinary personal stories from around the globe. Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 19th of September, these are our main stories. Canada says it's told India of its concerns that Indian intelligence services might be connected to the killing of an exiled Sikh leader. Five American prisoners who were detained for years in Iranian jails are on their way home as part of a complex exchange deal mediated by Qatar. And world leaders meeting at the United Nations in New York have warned that global attempts to end extreme poverty and tackle climate change are in reverse. Also in this podcast.
At $80 million a pop, the F-35 Lightning II Joint Strike Fighter is not the kind of thing you want to lose if you can help it.
But that is exactly what has happened. And now the US military is appealing to the public to help it find its stealth fighter jet following a mishap over South Carolina. We start in Canada, where the country's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says the Indian government could be behind the fatal shooting of a Canadian citizen in June in Canada. The Sikh leader Hardeep Singh Nijjar was shot dead outside a Sikh temple on the 18th of June in British Columbia. Mr. Trudeau made the announcement in a statement to Parliament.
Canadian security agencies have been actively pursuing credible allegations of a potential link between agents of the government of India and the killing of a Canadian citizen, Hardeep Singh Nijjar. Our top priorities have been, one, that our law enforcement and security agencies ensure the continued safety of all Canadians, and two, that all steps be taken to hold perpetrators of this murder to account.
Mr. Nijjar was a prominent Sikh leader in British Columbia, often voicing his support for separatists. India, in the past, had raised concerns about campaigners like him. Well, I heard more from the BBC's Nadine Youssef, who is in the Canadian city of Toronto.
Hardeep Singh Nijjar, he is a prominent Sikh activist and leader here in Canada, and he was murdered in mid-June at a parking lot outside a Sikh temple in British Columbia, specifically the city of Surrey. Police at the time said that he was shot dead by two masked men. India has previously sort of identified Mr. Nijjar as a terrorist, and he said that he has led a militant separatist group. And at the time of his death, he was actually in the process of planning a local referendum here in Canada on the creation of an independent Sikh state in India. And so since his death, you know, because of the accusation that the Indian government has leveled against him, his supporters here in Canada have been quite vocal, and they've accused India of being behind his murder. And at the time, police said it was a targeted incident, but they didn't specify who could be behind his killing.
And from the very beginning, when this happened, were there suspicions, or were there local or national politicians pointing the finger at the Indian state?
Politicians, for the most part, had been accusing India directly prior to today. We had one leader of the New Democratic Party here in Canada. He sort of mentioned that Canada should look at the murder of Mr. Nijjar, that it's serious, that it's clearly a targeted incident, and that it needs to investigate it. But nobody had sort of leveled such a clear accusation against India up until today. Now, his supporters have, you know, accused India of being behind the murder. And, you know, Mr. Nijjar, prior to his death, has said that he felt that he was being targeted and that he was receiving threats. So it's certainly part of the conversation, just not on a political level.
What about the specifics of what Justin Trudeau has said in Parliament today? I mean, has he just leveled the accusation? Has he pointed the finger? Are there more details?
So he basically said that Canadian intelligence has found a credible link between India and the murder, which happened on Canadian soil. What he specifically said is that they found found that agents of the Indian government may have carried out the killing. So that is specifically what he said. He wasn't very clear on details. They've been a bit vague on it, saying that the murder investigation is currently undergoing and they don't want to jeopardize it by saying too much. But essentially, he did point a clear link between what Canadian intelligence is saying, India, and the murder of Mr. Najjar.
So the murder investigation is ongoing, and at the same time, the Prime Minister has stood up and pointed the finger at the Indian government. That's what's happened.
Yes, he seems to think that he has enough evidence that links India to the murder. But, you know, we have not seen any of that evidence. It has not been made public. But, you know, I should say that this kind of comes after a testy meeting between Prime Minister Narendra Modi and Justin Trudeau at last week's G20 summit, in which Prime Minister Modi accused Canada of not doing enough to address what he called anti-India activities of extreme elements on Canadian soil. And so the relationship between the two has been testy for some time. It sort of culminated in today's announcement.
Nadine Youssef in Toronto. And I should add, as we record this podcast, that there's been no comment from India on Monday's allegations, though in the past, its government has denied any involvement. Now, five Americans with dual Iranian nationality have been freed after spending years in prison in Iran. Tehran will gain access to $6 billion worth of oil revenue as part of a rare and complex deal that's been brokered by Qatar. Five Iranians have also been released from US jails. On Monday afternoon, the Americans were flown to the Qatari capital Doha, where they embraced US officials and each other. President Biden announced fresh sanctions on Iran, saying it would continue to pay for its provocative actions. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, was there as the prisoners' plane landed in Doha.
The Qatar Airways plane finally landed as the sun was setting here in Doha. This was the moment which confirmed that five American citizens were finally free. One of them, 51-year-old Siamak Namazi, said in a statement their nightmare was over. He said he had dreamed of this day, every one of the 2,898 days he was held in Iran, most of them in the notorious Evin prison in Tehran. On the tarmac, the former prisoners embraced the waiting American and Qatari officials, then walked arm in arm. Inside the terminal, they took a call from the U.S. Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken. He issued a statement in Washington shortly after.
Today, their freedom, the freedom of these Americans for so long, unjustly imprisoned and detained in Iran, means some pretty basic things. Husbands and wives, fathers and children, grandparents can hug each other again.
The moment the plane touched down in Doha, U.S. President Joe Biden announced new sanctions against senior Iranian officials for their role in what he called wrongful detentions. U.S. officials insist that the Iranian money released in this deal will only be accessed by third parties for the purchase of non-sanctioned goods such as food and medicine. The former prisoners, now on their way home, thanked the U.S. president for putting their lives above politics.
Lise Doucette watching the plane land in Doha. Well, there has been plenty of criticism of the deal in the United States, with some people suggesting it would only encourage more hostage-taking. Perhaps to forestall such criticism, the US imposed further sanctions, as we've just mentioned, on Iran's intelligence ministry and on the former Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. I spoke to our North America correspondent, Nada Torfik, who's in New York, and asked her about the criticism of the US-Iran deal.
Several Republicans, both senators and representatives in Congress, have come out to say that while the U.S. should be, you know, unrelenting in its efforts to bring home detained Americans, that this now will just embolden America's enemies to turn to hostage taking, that it will put more Americans' safety and security at risk. And even Senator Ted Cruz of Texas went as far as to allege that the Biden administration had struck a secret nuclear deal with the Iranian regime that was being kept from Congress and the American people. So we've heard that criticism. They're also pointing to the dollar amount here, the $6 billion that has been unfrozen. But the White House has really hit back at these comments. They've said that the utmost priority for President Biden is to bring Americans home, that that's above politics. And they say that these $6 billion in funds that are in South Korea were payments that South Korea actually made to Iran for purchases of oil oil years ago, including during the last administration. And they say that it will only go to humanitarian transactions, food, medicine, agricultural products, and that if they find that Iran is trying to divert those funds, that they will take action to lock it up. And what we've really seen is statements from all of the families saying they are grateful to President Biden for making the difficult but necessary decision to prioritize American citizens over politics. Each of the families put out that statement. So clearly this is a very political, controversial decision. But from those five Americans' families, they have made a point to be public in thanking President Biden.
I mean, is there a hope and an ambition where you are in Washington and maybe perhaps at the United Nations that this will lower tensions between Iran and the U.S.? It's a good sign in terms of their very fragile relationship?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm here at the start of the UN General Assembly. We heard from the Secretary General spokesperson saying that, look, whenever there's cooperation like this, they're hopeful that it could help when, you know, there is a bit of unity, even if it is on just one very isolated incident. But other diplomats we spoke to, including, you know, Secretary Blinken, made it very clear that they don't see this as a major change in Iran-U.S. relations. And this is very much different from, say, the nuclear deal negotiations.
Nada Torfik in New York. So, how is Monday's news being viewed in Iran? Well, my colleague Rebecca Kesby spoke to Adnan Tabatabyeh, an Iranian analyst currently in Tehran.
Obviously, it is reported as a big triumph for the Islamic Republic, and that, in fact, the American side now had to give in. But at the same time, there is also the attempt, at least by the foreign ministry, to try and link it to the potential revitalization of the talks regarding the nuclear agreement. So it in fact goes both ways.
Interesting. And so what are your thoughts? Do you think that is possible? Because this, I mean, it seems like a dramatic movement to have these five detainees released. Could part of the understanding from Tehran been to try to encourage a better relationship with the United States?
At least it can open the path towards some more meaningful talks. We have to take into consideration that any resumption of the nuclear talks or anything close to the revitalization of the nuclear agreement had to be sold to the domestic scene, both in Tehran and in Washington. And in order to be able to do that, some sort of breakthrough in other fields and other domains had to be championed. And I think that this prisoner swap allows both sides to tell their domestic audience, we achieved something, and now we have some sort of justification to maybe pursue with talks on other issues as well.
Adnan Tabatabyeh in Tehran. World leaders meeting at the United Nations have warned that attempts to end extreme poverty and tackle climate change are going in reverse. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, called for a new plan to rescue the goals for sustainable development. James Lendell is in New York.
The so-called Sustainable Development Goals, known as SDGs, were supposed to be met by 2030. Mr. Guterres wants UN leaders to promise a £400 billion cash stimulus to kickstart the SDGs, new forms of debt relief for poorer countries, and more focus from international banks on development needs. In a statement, the world leaders promised action on these issues, but diplomats and charities fear the global cost of living crisis and geopolitical divisions over Russia's invasion of Ukraine may make it harder for countries to focus on the Sustainable Development Goals, let alone agree how to get them back on track.
We're going to go to Ukraine now, where the government continues to fight Russian forces on multiple fronts. But the Zelensky government is also engaged in its own internal battles against corruption. The country's new defence minister, Rustem Umerov, has removed six of his deputies just weeks after he was brought in, partly in the wake of allegations surrounding corruption in defence procurement. The reshuffle comes as Ukraine's military is reporting its forces are recapturing more territory in the east of the country. I spoke to our Kyiv correspondent, James Waterhouse, for the latest, and I started by asking him what's behind this apparent reboot at the defence ministry.
Now, on a surface level, a minister replacing his whole team is unsurprising, and he will want to have his best people, in his eyes, closest to him. So those who've been removed include the rather prominent military spokesperson, Anna Myler, who many will have seen behind podiums giving updates on situations across the front line in military uniform. She was recently criticised for giving reports that were ultimately not the case in terms of liberation. Now, it's a difficult job, you could argue, in briefing journalists on a fast-moving situation. But I think if you look at Anna Myler, if you look at Mr. Umerov's predecessor, Alexei Reznikov, they have struggled to keep claims of corruption out of the ministry.
Can I ask you about her, though? I mean, it seems to me from what you said that maybe this was someone who was spinning too much, frankly. And when expectation management about the spring offensive is so important, particularly maybe with audiences on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., maybe that's another reason she's gone?
I think the government is trying to both appeal to its population, saying, look, when we mobilise you, when we call you up to fight, we are doing so through a system that is credible. But there is also an international audience that President Zelensky is pandering to as well. He and Ukraine have long had political ambitions of joining the European Union and NATO. It is continuing to receive billions of dollars of military and humanitarian aid. This feeds into that as well.
Just one quickly, on those operational issues on the battlefield, are we seeing signs today perhaps of some successes in Bakhmut, or is that not the case?
We are seeing probing attacks. Well, they go beyond probing, really. Certainly, we've seen two villages taken south of Bakhmut. We've seen Ukrainian infantry sustain a sizable land grab south of Zaporizhia, where it is desperately hoping to punch through. But that punch we have not seen yet. They've broken through the Russian first lines of defence. But I think the most interesting area we are seeing at the moment are these successful missile attacks by the Ukrainians on targets in Crimea, when we're talking about naval bases, when we're talking about Russian air defence systems. You can see what is happening here. There is the bread and butter of trying to liberate territory kilometre by kilometre. But they are also trying to isolate Russian troops by taking out air defence systems, supply lines, to bring the question of Crimea into question. At the moment, Robin, it is Crimea, a place Russia has tried to portray as a fortress, which is looking more fragile for the occupiers at the moment.
James Waterhouse in Ukraine. The US military has appealed to the public to help it find an advanced stealth fighter jet that's gone missing. Officials say the F-35 warplane simply vanished following what's been described as a mishap over the state of South Carolina. The pilot ejected safely. Our North America correspondent, Gary O'Donoghue, has more.
At $80 million a pop, the F-35 Lightning II Joint Strike Fighter is not the kind of thing you want to lose if you can help it. But that's exactly what the US Marine Corps seems to have done. Not on the hostile environment of the battlefield taking incoming fire, but somewhere over a small part of South Carolina. Fighter Attack Training Squadron 501 released a statement yesterday after the pilot ejected from the plane, describing the incident as a mishap and asking for the public's help to find it. The Marine Corps was tight-lipped on whether the plane's transponder was activated or not, which should allow them to locate it. More worryingly, questions to the military have elicited a resounding silence on whether the jet was carrying any armaments. The search is focused around two lakes between the cities of Charleston and the state capital, Columbia, a distance of about 100 miles, but so far to no avail. And to save anyone the trouble of looking it up, it's not all that close to the Bermuda Triangle.
Gary O'Donoghue. Still to come. Do you find those sounds really irritating? I definitely find the second one irritating. Well, help may be at hand.
Our planet's climate is changing.
We are in the midst of a climate crisis.
The climate question speaks to those hit the hardest.
The problems caused by deforestation and the environment are huge. We are in big trouble.
And asks what we can do to soften the impact for the future.
We do have the means to do something about this.
Try and reduce our reliance on fossil fuels.
Way more wind and solar.
I do have a lot of faith for the future.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
We've been reporting a lot from Libya in the last week, and we're going to go back to Derna in eastern Libya now, where hundreds of people have taken to the streets to demand accountability for the devastating floods which swept through the city a week ago. Thousands of people died when two dams collapsed. Rescue workers are still pulling bodies from the sea and ruined buildings. Our correspondent Anna Foster is there. She sent this report.
Turkish rescuers have brought us into this normally sealed-off zone, where they are searching for victims. They're using all of the experience that they brought from the earthquake in Turkey back in February. And in this area, you can see how high the water came into these buildings. There are tree roots and branches 20 to 30 meters above the ground, and they've recovered victims from the fifth and sixth stories of these apartment blocks. And the sound that you can hear is heavy lifting equipment that is finding new channels, new ways for them to get inside and search for more victims.
Amid the grief and anger is that urgent task of rebuilding lives. Figures from the UN say tens of thousands of survivors have been displaced by the flooding. Some have left Derna, others are living with family, and buildings like this school have been repurposed as shelters.
It's quite noisy and echoey here in the school corridor where the children are playing. But if we walk into one of the classrooms, through the doorway and past a blanket that's been hung up over the tables to give just a little bit of privacy, this is where families are living. And obviously they don't have really any of their possessions. Everything was washed away. But you can see where there are donated mattresses, donated blankets, and families now sleeping in each of these classrooms all the way along the school corridor.
Anna Foster in Derna. Well, there is continuing controversy and so many questions about why those two dams above the city failed with such devastating consequences. The head of the Eastern Administration in divided Libya has blamed nature for the failure of the two dams. But the Libyan hydrologist Abdul Wani Sashour disagrees. And he's been speaking to my colleague Julian Marshall via a translator.
Today I've been looking at the designs of the architect company that designed these dams, and actually their report from 1970 has recommended building three dams, not just two. Because the company building the dams and recommending this design recommended three different dams, but the government of Libya only built two and did not go ahead with building the third one. So these two were overloaded, and in particular Sadd Bou Mansour been overloaded hydrologically with more water than it can contain, and that's what led to this disaster and inundating Derna with all these floodwaters.
I mean, documents released this week show a contract was issued to a Turkish company in 2020 to strengthen both dams, yet no work was done. Were you aware of this?
I've been aware of this since 2010, not just 2020. I've been a professor at Omar al-Mukhtar University, Derna campus. So ever since 2010, I've been driving on that road. I've been driving over the body of the dam. And I remember seeing the Turkish company operating there. It started functioning there to strengthen the body of the dam in 2010. But came 2011 with the Arab Spring or the Libyan Revolution. So they stopped everything and they upped the sticks and removed all the equipment. So work had stopped. Came 2020 and the company came back having been given a new contract at new cost. And nothing had been done since, even though they got the contract, but they hadn't started working.
The Libyan hydrologist Abdul Wanis Ashour. Now, scientists here in the UK, in Scotland, say they've discovered an alternative to an ingredient that is estimated to be in half of all food and cosmetic products. And it's blamed as well for deforestation across the world. A research team from Queen Margaret University in Edinburgh say their alternative to palm oil is actually healthier for humans. They also say it would mean significant environmental benefits in places where natural forest habitat has been replaced with vast palm oil plantations. One of the lead developers on the project, Katrina Little, has been telling my colleague Evan Davismore.
Palm oil is a very cultivated product that's grown in various exotic areas of the planet, and it's very saturated, and it's also really quite unsustainable. So we've created a product that's a lot more sustainable, around about 70% less carbon emissions, and it's considerably healthier. So we've been able to get a 30% calorie reduction, 30% fat reduction, and over 80% saturated fat reduction.
And what is it? So what is your product?
It's a combination of rapeseed oil and some clever fibres and proteins.
Right. And I mean, as I understand it, palm oil, which is used ubiquitously in food and cosmetics,
yeah,
is very difficult to replace. So this is something of been a long, hard search for scientists.
Yeah, I mean, the two things, it's two different goals here. One is the sustainability thing and the other is the health one. Some people are going just for the sustainability thing. We're trying to do both at the same time. So it is a challenge, but we've actually tested this out in a number of different products, mostly bakery. So cakes, biscuits, shortbread, those kind of things. And we have put it through what's called a specialist sensory panel, so a trained panel, and they can't distinguish the difference.
Katharina, just explain to me why we use palm oil so much, why we need a replacement for it and why... we don't just use less of it and just have, because, you know, when we cook at home, we don't pour palm oil into things.
Well, you do. That's the thing, because it's in so many of the ingredients you cook with as well. So it's in everything from margarine to cake, to sauces, to peanut butter. It's in everything, really. It's in a lot of different products. So you are, by definition, cooking with palm fat anyway.
Why do we use so much of it? It's as opposed to other forms of fat.
It's very functional. It gives you really good texture and flavour in your end product. Gives you great shelf life. And, you know, so for all these things, it's like a really functional ingredient. So it's a shame that it's just really unhealthy and it's not very sustainable. But functionally, it's a great ingredient to use from a taste and texture profile point of view.
Katharina Little on a replacement for the ubiquitous palm oil. Now, I'm sorry about this. Quite a few people have an irrational hatred of certain everyday sounds. And if that sounds like you, you might find the following noises slightly jarring. It's the apple eating. I really don't like the apple eating. Well, for those of you with this condition, you'll be pleased that it has a name. Misophonia is what it's called, and a new book, Sounds Like Misophonia, examines the phenomenon. The author has led a study that concludes that nearly one in five people have it in some form. Jane Gregory wrote the book from the Department of Experimental Psychology at the University of Oxford, and Evan Davis asked her what her personal experience with misophonia is.
When I was younger, it was like a real rage. I just got an instant flash of anger when I heard these sounds and couldn't concentrate on anything else. I remember at school, I used to have to, I had a Walkman that I would like feed up through my school uniform and had the clanking tape in my pocket playing music so that I could, literally so I could concentrate in class because of the clicking pens and all the rustling of paper and all that sort of stuff. Nowadays, the main way it affects me is if I'm really trying to concentrate and there's a ticking clock or pigeons outside my window or something pulling my attention away, that's when I get the most frustrated. But I don't get that intense rage anymore. But I know that a lot of people get that sort of feeling of anger or panic in response to these sounds.
Yeah, that sounds much more serious. I have a particular thing with chewing gum. I'm okay if I'm chewing gum and someone else is chewing gum. If they're chewing gum and I'm not chewing gum, I do feel intense irritation. But I wonder how much I should blame myself for that, of just being perhaps a bit intolerant. It's different for chewing of gum. I do find that irritating. I don't find it annoying if they're eating an apple or if they're drinking a glass of water. But what is the difference between just being intolerant and annoyed, easily annoyed, and having misophonia?
There seems to be something slightly different happening in the brain in misophonia. So it's not just feeling annoyed by it. It's that the brain has somehow sort of paired these sounds with a really intense emotional reaction. So almost like a fight or flight kind of response. So it's not just being annoyed, and most people could relate to being annoyed. It's more that really intense sort of physical reaction and something just different happening in the brain, which they've shown in studies using brain scans that you can actually see different connections happening in the brain when people react with misophonia.
Okay, so that is useful to know. Now, what do you do about it? What is the best way of living in human society where these noises are routine and you're going to be very unlucky to stop people making any kinds of sounds, clearing their throats or coughing or clicking a pen? What's the best way of treating it?
Yeah, they're really normal human sounds, so it is pretty hard to tell people to just stop living, basically, because most people aren't doing these sounds deliberately, and sometimes the sounds are excessive, but you're right, it's really hard to tell people to stop doing those sounds. So on a day-to-day basis, lots of people with misophonia just have earplugs or headphones or something ready to go with them if they need to be able to concentrate or get away from a sound. For sort of longer-term change, and this is one of the things that I talk about in the book, is actually trying to create new experiences with those sounds so that you can change those brain connections and actually get a less intense reaction to the sounds.
What's gone wrong with the brain that it suffers from this? It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, is there some evolutionary reason that you can think of why the brain might overreact? I can see why people get terrified of spiders or snakes. You know, these can be dangerous, but a clicking pen, for goodness sake, how can that be? What's going on in the head that would occur?
Yeah, well, if you use the example of spiders and snakes, that's a really good example because it's reasonable to be afraid of spiders and snakes. But also, if you live in a country where spiders aren't dangerous and you still have a really intense fear reaction as though they are really dangerous, then your brain has made a connection with spiders that is disproportionate to the actual level of danger. And that's probably a better comparison for misophonia, is that these are sounds that if you're walking home late at night, it would be really good for your brain to be able to tune into footsteps so you could hear if someone was following you or something like that. Long ago when we were living out on the plains, being able to see a rustle in the grass of a potential predator or something like that, being able to tune into these sounds does have a survival feature for the group. So it makes sense that some of us pay attention to these sounds and don't tune them out. But just like somebody who can't even look at a picture of a spider, even though they live in a country where spiders aren't dangerous, some people with misophonia react to those sounds as if there is immediate danger or threat or violation or some kind of social threat, maybe, which is disproportionate to the level of danger.
Jane Gregory from Oxford University. Now let's end on the Italian fishing industry, which is battling a plague of blue crabs, an invasive and predatory species that has been having a dramatic impact on traditional shellfish production off the Italian coast. Some reports suggest as many as 90% of Italy's young clams have been devoured by the crabs. But one person's invasive pest is another person's culinary opportunity, it seems. Tim Franks spoke to Yim Hung Su, a specialist on Korean food and director of the Korean Culture and Arts Centre in the UK.
Maybe it could be a disaster to Italian people, but in the view of Korean side, it is kind of a festival.
A festival in what way?
So, festival in a delicious way, because the Korean people really love the crabs and they are making many different type of foods with the crabs. So at the moment, when Korean people heard about the blue crab crisis in Italy, why they are get rid of the blue crabs? Because we can enjoy the crabs.
So in other words, the Italians, South Koreans are thinking the Italians are mad to throw this stuff away because yes, it's absolutely delicious. Is there a hope in South Korea that even if the Italians don't have a taste for the blue crab, that they'll end up being exported to South Korea?
So they are trying to import blue crabs from Italy to Korea in very cheap prices. I tried in Tunisia last year. It was great. Could make spicy season the blue crab. Can deep fry it. We can steam it. And we can shallow fry it, stir fry it. Many, many different ways to enjoy the blue crabs.
Right, so that's fascinating. So you went to Tunisia recently in order to taste the blue crab. I mean, presumably this is an invasive species for Tunisia as well.
Same species, actually.
Same species, yeah. But yeah. I mean, but not native to the waters off North Africa. And what was Tunisia doing with the blue crab? Was it being? I mean, I can't believe it's much part of Tunisian cuisine. So were they exporting the blue crab to South Korea?
Yes, they also had a big problem with the blue crabs. The embassy of Korea in Tunisia, they found the blue crab. It was like a treasure. So they introduced the blue crab to Korea market. Now they are selling many tons of blue crab to South Korea at the moment.
You mentioned several ways of using the blue crab in food dishes, but there's one dish that I will now mispronounce, which is
Kanjang Gejang.
Right. Your pronunciation is almost as good as mine. Tell me about this one other dish, which I think is a particular speciality.
So, ganjang gejang means the salted fermented crab in Korean cuisine. So basically, we are using very salty soy sauce, and also we are adding some flavor with the garlic, ginger, spring onions, pear, pepper. This is very salty, but very tasty. And many people are calling ganjang gejang is the rice sieve, because that ganjang gejang is make us to eat more rice than normal. It is really amazingly great and very tasty.
Yim Hung Soo from the Korean Culture and Arts Centre in the UK on his country's love for the blue crab. Right, that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.